I'm Jesse Thorne. Welcome to The Turnaround. It's the show where I interview interviewers about interviewing. It's a partnership between MaximumFun.org and the Columbia Journalism Review. Today, the British documentarian Louis Theroux. So, Louis has dedicated a huge portion of his life to subcultures. The stranger, the more fascinating, the better, whether they're scary or friendly or ridiculous. I'm talking about UFO hunters, neo-Nazi groups, religious cults, houses of prostitution. Louis's been working for the BBC making documentaries about folks like this, folks who live in these extreme social and cultural situations, for more than 15 years. He's done a lot of his work in the United States. One of the groups that he visited was the Westboro Baptist Church. They're the folks famous for picketing at, among other things, soldiers' funerals. He made a documentary about them in 2007 called The Most Hated Family in America. And he went to Topeka, Kansas, where they lived, with a film crew to visit some of the members in their homes. Here's a little bit.
But am I right in thinking, though, that you know that Jesus actually wasn't a big thing for him? He had other priorities rather than homosexuality.
See,
and it's not one of the Ten Commandments, is it?
Yes.
Which one?
Thou shalt not commit adultery.
That's not being gay. It's cheating on someone.
The streets of this nation are full of married men having fag sex. That's adultery. So don't try to pretend that you don't come under the umbrella of adultery just because you're a fag. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
This is Gabriel.
How do you do?
Go put your stuff away. And Grace.
How do you do?
This is Grace.
Louis has dedicated his career to living in this weird liminal space between the scariest and most unusual people in the world and just normal humanity. He's a pretty incredible guy. Thrilled to have him on The Turnaround. Let's get right into it. So, Louis, how would you characterize what it is that you do? Because it's a very specific thing. You've been doing it for quite a while.
I go among people who are in some way involved in lifestyles that are or belief systems that are outside the mainstream, but also have a profound moral dimension to them, where they're viewed as often questionable, controversial, sometimes hateful. And I attempt to build relationships with them and get to know them, ideally over a period of days or even weeks, and I make documentaries in which you see those relationships develop.
Well, do you remember, like, the first time that you were with one of these groups of people? Was there a moment when you thought, this is a thing that should be my thing that I do?
I do know that when I first got hired on a TV show, it was in 1994, I was 23, and Michael Moore had the TV show TV Nation, which was just gearing up. And he basically, I went along for an interview having no TV experience, and he I guess, thought, well, there's something in this kind of bespectacled, skinny, kind of slightly sallow, kind of shambolic figure who that will make an interesting contrast with the wild and woolly outer reaches of American culture. And the first story he sent me on, you know, at the time I was literally, because the magazine I'd been working for as a journalist, it was Spy magazine, it had gone belly up, and I was temping in the publishing industry, doing sort of proofreading and fact-checking. And then he sort of said, you know what, he called me up and said, after the interview, and said, I'm going to send you off and get ready, you're leaving tomorrow. And the story was about groups, religious groups that think the end of the world is around the corner. Millennialist cults and sects. And I remember thinking, well, I have no qualifications to do this. I'm very afraid of doing this because I feel profoundly unqualified. But I am very excited to speak to these people. And maybe that curiosity will carry me through.
Well, it seems like in part, for at least from my perspective, watching your shows, which I have since they were on, I never saw TV Nation, but since you're on Bravo many years ago, one of your qualifications is your lack of qualifications. You lead with your lack of qualifications. And it seems like you are always foregrounding your this is a judgmental word, not intended judgmentally, but like ignorance or, you know, that you always are bringing it back to, gee whiz, I just don't know.
I think that's fair. I mean, I think you have to start with a sort of, I mean, in terms of how I work, it's to do with not coming across as too slick or too well-oiled, you know, kind of polished. It's not something I do try and be groomed, but I, you know, it's just not something I'm that interested in. And despite my best efforts, I usually look a little bit rumpled. But it turns out, you know, and I have glasses. It's not, I suppose I could get LASIKs, but I've got used to having
glasses.
Yeah,
not if you want to keep having a career.
Yeah.
Really. And those are your money glasses.
Well, it's been said, funnily enough, my wife said the same thing. But I don't, you know, those aren't strategies. That's just who I am. But it turns out those are useful in addition to being real accoutrements of my genuine self. They are also useful in terms of coming across, I think, as less intimidating. You know, you think about, I don't know this for a fact, but my vision of like a 60 Minutes correspondent, one of the high-end guys like Morley Safer or
Mike Wallace,
is that the producers go in and soften up the access, and then when they're ready, they call Mike Wallace, and he arrives by helicopter and kind of walks down a red carpet into the, you know, and the lights are all ready to go. It's the diametrical opposite of my way of doing things, which is to sort of go in softly and approach, you know, almost apologetically, and to try and let the person know that I'm at their disposal for as, you know, long or as little as they like, And you know, just send this message of I really want to get to know you and understand what makes you tick.
I mean, that is a mode that you will go into. I mean, there's scenes in your new feature film, which is called My Scientology Movie, where you're literally being evicted from what may or may not be Scientology-owned land. Turned out not to be, but which they believed to be.
The road is open to the public, but they claim that it was a private road and call the police, yes, yeah. Outside their secret base.
So, like, literally, a woman who's been yelling at you has gotten into her car, and there's this moment where you turn to this guy who's standing behind her running a camera, which they do all the time. So that they can, they say to make their own documentary, but so that they can document if you're twisting them around or whatever, right?
Correct.
And perhaps to intimidate you as well. But they, you turn to this guy and you say, oh, well, will you talk to me? Yeah. In this voice, like in this, like, are you my mother voice?
Well, I don't know if I was quite as whiny and sappy as that, but I did sort of say, you know, are you in the Sea Org? you know, and then I think I say, are you making a documentary as well? What's yours about? But I think, you know, for me, those high tension confrontations in which Scientologists are attempting to handle me, the onus was on me to diffuse the situation and not get into a sort of a mirror image of what they were doing. I didn't want to be shouting back at them. And one of the almost my catchphrase in the film is saying, are you in the Sea Org? Like, it's something anytime someone comes up to me from Scientology, I ask them if they're in the Sea Org, which is their inner sanctum of their most dedicated kind of clergy. But they don't, strikingly, they don't engage. And I think it's part of their training to present an impregnable wall of kind of non-engagement, because they view me as a suppressive person, and that dealing with me is not just kind of bad PR, but actually kind of dangerous for them. They'll be exposed to my negativity.
Was it weird for you, someone who has made his career out of penetrating impenetrable walls, you know, connecting with people who otherwise don't necessarily want to be publicly portrayed, to encounter people who were so disciplined about simply not showing you anything?
It was a huge challenge. And in some ways, it ran counter to everything that I you know, set out to do or had been doing in my work for the preceding 20 years. And because, in fact, most of the people who turn up for my documentaries, they're there because they want to share something. You know, you asked, was there a moment when I thought, this is what I do, this is what I'm good at? It was during the taping of the Millennium segment for Michael Moore. And, you know, 23 years old, I felt totally out of my depth. But I remember on day three, we arrived in a remote area of Montana in the Bitterroot Mountains. And we went up to a trailer, and there were two neo-Nazi guys inside who'd formerly belonged to Aryan nations. And they are full-blown kind of white supremacists. And I remember being a bit nervous and thinking, like, how's this going to go down and what will they think of me? And halfway through, or even a few minutes into the conversation, I remember thinking, wow, these guys really just almost seem to want to like me and relate to me. And they were kind of reaching out in this really striking way. And I remember thinking, this is absolutely bizarre. From thinking I was going into a hostile environment, I was aware that I was suddenly in this environment in which they felt totally emotionally open, and that this was, that I could have a conversation that was wholly other and very, in an odd way, I suppose, human with them. Now, with Scientology, they weren't offering that, and it was a prolonged period of soul searching, of thinking about how do I, you know, I'm not being invited in. How do I, by what right do I do this story? I don't want to kind of upset them needlessly. Why would I do a film about them if they have made it clear they don't want a film made on them? And I only resolved it by realizing, well, really, the film's as much about ex-Scientology. And chiefly about this guy Marty Rathbun, who was very prominent in Scientology, and about his experience both inside and outside Scientology, and that he gave me the permission to get inside.
Do you think that part of what you do is aided by the fact that you are, especially when you're making things in the United States, which has been much of your career, an alien, like that you are culturally and, you know, legally, you know, you might as well be a storybook character, essentially.
I think that's definitely there. I think also,
like, because as you were describing talking to the Aryan Nation guys, I was thinking of I have a friend who has been making a show for CNN, and he's a comedian. His name is W. Kamau Bell, and he did a show with white supremacist dudes. And it occurred to me, like, right, not just because he's black, substantially because he's black, but not just because he's black, he walks into that situation in a very different way because he is an American. Like, he is, as far as they're concerned, outside the fact that he has cameras and is a show businessy dude, he is part of this world that they understand, whereas you are as a profound outsider.
I arrive like Harry Potter.
Yes. I wasn't going to say Harry Potter.
Stepping off his broomstick.
Yes.
And saying, want to play some Quidditch? But
I can only presume that there's a monthly lunch date with you, Harry Potter, and John Ronson somewhere in England.
That's right.
Somewhere magical in England. The
Come along.
Gentleman's Eyeglasses Club.
I think there's something in what you say, and I think also working for the BBC, having that as a calling card, and I used to, yeah, I think there's almost a sense of safety, and there's, you know, this far off magical storybook country in which the program will air, which somehow won't have any impact on their lives. I think there's a little bit of that. I think in general, actually, I may be wrong. It's hard to judge, but I think there's a cultural difference between the US and the UK. I think Americans are more comfortable bearing their souls generally. I have done shows in the UK, but it's always more of a challenge. And I think the accent probably helps a little bit.
Was there a time when you were less comfortable with emotionally charged social interactions?
In my private life or on camera?
Well, either way. I mean, if it's the former, you might owe me $150 for this hour, but
I think I feel like I'm a grown man now. I'm 46 years old. Literally half my life I've spent doing this, and I feel more comfortable calling BS on stuff that I think is wrongheaded. And I'm still not hugely confrontational, but I am more okay with taking on subjects in a sort of assertive way. And you can slightly see it. I did a show about the Westboro Baptist Church, and the first and it was all sort of, tell me what you believe. This seems really weird, but explain yourselves about why you go around holding pickets and waving placards with offensive anti-gay slogans on them. And then I went back about 5 years later to do a follow-up, and it's striking how I felt able on the second, or I don't know, felt it was necessary to be more aggressive. And I think it's probably a good thing. You know, I don't feel, I feel like I know enough about more opinions or something. I feel more comfortable in taking on a slightly more adversarial role.
That's interesting to me because to my mind, and like if I am, feel the feelings that I have in my chest right now, it's, I feel like I would be a lot more comfortable, even maybe in a physically dangerous situation, being confrontational than I would doing something that you do a lot, which is shutting your mouth in a really weird situation and letting the person say a second thing or a third thing.
That's interesting because if I get when I do Q&As and things, the question I get asked perhaps more than any other is, how do you stay so calm, or how do you prevent yourself from getting annoyed or coming back at the person you're interviewing? And it's really striking because it's one of those questions that is sort of premised on a false idea, which is that I'm holding back. And most of the time, I just don't feel it's my role. I don't feel either, professionally, but also I don't feel emotionally compelled to kind of take it there. I just, I don't like to think too much about it because in a weird way, maybe it suggests a sort of certain moral or emotional distance, but I genuinely don't have to kind of bite my tongue. I'm just sort of interested in what's going on.
That's interesting. I did an interview once with Bette Davis, who's a musician, very brilliant funk musician whose career was in the 1970s. And just look up Bette Davis on Wikipedia and make sure it's not the actress. And she was like a recluse, a very literal recluse, had not done any interviews in decades. And her records got re-released, and she agreed to do one interview by phone if it patched through her record company, so no one knew her phone number and like all this other stuff. And I interviewed her on the phone. And she was very lovely, completely polite, and just did not want to say anything, basically, which usually I'm interviewing for Bullseye. I'm interviewing celebrities promoting projects, or at least creative people promoting projects that created these projects out of this passion that they have things to say about. And one of the hardest things that I've ever done in my career was to let her say something in response to a question and just wait for her to say another thing. That was so scary and hard for me. And that is something that you do in your shows. You'll do it and run it. I mean, I'm not talking about on the cutting room floor. I haven't seen your dailies. I'm talking about in your documentaries, there are moments where you ask a question, someone gives you an answer, and you wait until they give you more answer.
Because they are interviews, but they're also dramatic encounters. And, I think the best ones have an ebb and flow to them. And there comes a point where a difficult question is asked, you know, or a non-response can be as interesting as a response. And, you know, a lot of the things I suppose I've done over the years have revolved around almost expanding the frame of the conversation so that the little bits around the words are become more meaningful. And I think how you say hello is interesting, and I think how you leave the room can also be interesting. And very often in an interview on camera, when the camera resets, you know, quite often there's a moment when the director will say, okay, that was great, now we're going to get some wides. And the conversation becomes much more interesting at that point, because somehow the interviewee or the person I'm with settles and thinks, okay, we've done the interview now. And then they kind of settle into a more human mode. Or you as an interviewer can revisit something that came up and say, you know, when you – and you can lower your voice a bit and say, when you said the thing about and don't mean in an artificial way. There's a sort of natural impulse to say, when you mentioned Betty Davis, you know, and then you come back to it, and then the subject gets reset and reapproached. I think all of that it's like small things like that can create a much more textured encounter.
Do you have a second voice in your head when you're doing this? As you said, you do it over days, weeks, months. But do you have a second voice in your head when you're on camera that is putting together the piece or the story as you are talking to the person?
I would say yes. And you have to, because, you know, unlike interviews that are live to tape, I'm constantly aware both that, huge swathes can be just cut out and dropped. And I can I'm conscious, like, have we got what it was that I was sort of trying to get to, like the question that I was hoping to get answered? And then you, there's a sense of, and sometimes I can just drill in a way that maybe isn't helpful. And usually in most of the stories I do, they are about something, the story can be distilled into almost a single question. So the porn industry, the question is simply, what is the cost of taking the, you know, the most intimate act, you know, the act of sexual procreation, and publicizing it and doing it more or less on command for the purpose of consumption? And, you know, and in a lot of them, like white supremacism, a lot of it is, what are the human stakes for someone adopting the most abhorrent form of ideology? How does that then affect the lives of the people who believe in it? And, you know, in all of these, there's a sort of profound self-contradiction. And I just like to kind of keep revisiting those ideas so that sometimes the conversations, if you saw the raw footage, they'd be probably pretty boring, because I might be just coming back to the same thing.
There are these moments in all of these documentaries that feel like you have spent the time to build this relationship. And I think that you're right, that a lot of the times the other thing that your pieces are about, that your documentaries are about, is about that relationship that you build with them. It is like especially the new movie, but often this is the case, that it's the story of you building a relationship with a person and the weird difficulties of Louis Theroux, guy with a bunch of cameras, and a person with unusual beliefs or lifestyle or whatever, bonding. That is like part of the story. Mm. But often part of that story is, and it's true in the Scientology movie, is, you know, there is 2/3, 50%, 60% of the story is you connecting with this person. And there's 20% of the story that is you pushing on their emotional bruises.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's true. And I'm conscious as well that, you know, I don't in any way set out to upset people. And I like to think I have a reasonably good sense of when I'm pushing too hard. But it happens from time to time that in re-asking the same question a person hits a wall or they reach a point of exasperation. And more than once, someone's totally lost it with me. I did one about hunting. And in hunting, it was big game hunting as done on game farms, what they sometimes call canned hunting in South Africa. So the animals aren't really wild in the sort of sense that they're roaming free on the range, but they're in extremely large game farms. And then big, high-paying international hunters, often American, come and say, I want to bag me a lion. Can you find me one? And they drive them out and they find the lion and ping it.
They don't always talk like that.
No. In fact, none of them talk like
Sometimes
that.
They talk like this. Hello, I am American.
I didn't meet that guy. But I did. One of the guys was called Pete Warren, and he was South African, and he was basically raising lions so that they could be hunted. And I just sort of said, the question was, is it, you know, to what extent is this really a kind of sporting exercise? Isn't there a basic contradiction, almost a kind of theme park dimension to this, in which we're creating a simulacrum of old school Hemingway-esque hunting in which everything is controlled? The lions are raised. I mean, you could just kind of put chips in the lions and track them by satellite. And you know, it's not really that different. Anyway, I didn't say literally that, but I said it's a bit like tennis without a net. And I remember he went ballistic. And it's this uncomfortable feeling of, he said, you've asked me that question 15 times. And he just I thought he was going to, it was that moment he said, oh, I think he might punch me now. I think this has got to the point of physical conflict, which it didn't. But it was awful. I felt really, I really felt a little bit sick, like, oh, I've really sent him off the deep end.
Well, do you feel like part of that response that you get from people sometimes is about you repeating questions because that's how television documentary work works? But part of it also is about them feeling like you are betraying this relationship?
I think, I don't really know. I think he was a volatile character, and I think I tend to think more often than not, actually, contributors are agreeing to be in the film because they want to chew on whatever that knot of contradiction is in whatever they do, you know, and that in fact sometimes it's a chance to deal with things that they deal with in a daily way, you know. And rather than – I try and see it – and I don't think I'm 100% wrong on this – that they see it as an opportunity. You know, that actually I'm giving them the space to confront and disabuse people about whatever it is that everyone says is the problem with what they do or the contradiction. So, you know, it's more an exception than the rule that they that the contributors spin out. So when you go to the Westboro Baptist Church and say you claim to love everyone and believe in Christianity, but what you do is deeply hateful and seems to go against everything that Christ preached, and not to mention that you're kind of in some feedback loop of your own, of kind of keeping the making the outside world hate you to convince you that they're hateful. They kind of lap it up. Like that's part. That's the whole dynamic that they want to kind of talk about.
What about when it's people who are less specifically gross and awful, like like people who believe in UFOs or mm-hmm. something like that, where they're, you know, they just want to share this thing that they think is cool.
The UFO, I made a show about UFOs in my first series of Weird Weekends, and in some ways it's an outlier in terms of the things that I've done, because there really isn't, by my lights, that much of a story there, because it's a story in which the beliefs to some extent have no consequences for the people who hold them. Mm. They are, if you say I was on board a flying saucer, people will think you're a little bit fringe, maybe, but maybe in the circles that they move in, they wouldn't. And actually, it was a tricky one for me to make, because it doesn't really involve any deep sense of emotional, you know, or psychic angst for them. So I like that show because the people are so, you know, they're sort of colorful and fun and a little bit, there's a touch of con artistry about some of them in the way they, one guy is called Thor Templar and he says he's killed 10 space aliens and he's selling gadgets like psionic helmets to protect you from aliens and little space guns that that will shoot aliens if the aliens try and attack you. But it was a tricky one to make in a certain way because it doesn't really arrive anywhere as a sort of portrait of human psychology.
Stick around. We'll be right back with more of my conversation with Louis Theroux after this. It's The Turnaround.
Hey, guys, this is Adam Conover. You may know me from my True TV show, Adam Ruins Everything. Well, guess what? Now we're doing a podcast version right here on Maximum Fun. What we do is we take all the interesting, fascinating experts that we talk to for just a couple minutes on the show, and we sit with them for an entire podcast, really going deep and getting into the fascinating details of their work. Find Adam Ruins Everything wherever you get your podcasts or at MaximumFun.org.
The Dead Pilot Society podcast brings you hilarious comedy pilots that were never made, featuring actors like Aubrey Plaza, Andy Richter, Paul F. Tompkins, John Hodgman, Adam Scott, Molly Shannon, Busy Phillips, Tom Lennon, Anna Camp, Laurie Metcalf, Alicia Day, Michael Ian Black, Adam Savage, Paul Scheer, Ben Schwartz, Skylar Astin, Mae Whitman, Josh Molina, Ben Feldman, Nicole Byer, Jason Ritter, Sarah Chalk, Steve Agee, Jane Levy, Allison Tolman, Danielle Nicolette, Casey Wilson, Anna Ortiz, Lorraine Newman, June Diane Raphael, Kiernan Shipka, Ed Week, Zach Knight, and Carrie Kenny Silver, John Ross Bowie, Jamie Denbo, Janet Varney, Alexander Forsyth, Matt Gorley,
and many more. Listen at MaximumFun.org, iTunes, or wherever you download podcasts.
It's The Turnaround. I'm Jesse Thorne. I'm talking to Louis Theroux, documentary filmmaker. Let's get back to my conversation. Are there films that you've worked on, documentaries that you've worked on, having done this for a long time now, where the process of doing it made you reevaluate the morality of your methods? I mean, not in a grand sense, but in particular ways?
Well, my Scientology movie is maybe a good example because I don't know if you know, but Marty Rathbun, the main contributor, has now denounced and disavowed the film. And he's written a blog that was quite painful for me to read in which he said, I've been taken advantage of. I don't feel this is an accurate film. They've used deceptive techniques. It's a fantasy cooked up by Louis Theroux and his director, John Dower.
And he is an ex-Scientologist, formerly one of the inner circle of Scientologists who's
Absolutely.
Denounced Scientology and agreed on an unpaid basis to sort of serve as your
Correct.
Tour guide of ex-Scientology.
Yes, and he was the right-hand man for many years to David Miscavige, who's the head of Scientology. So there are many ex-Scientologists, but there's only one who was at that level and who was so involved in some of the more questionable deeds of the church as well. He would run private investigators who would infiltrate the lives of ex-members and keep tabs on them. He would run something called the blow drill, which was when people left, he'd kind of go and use psychological influence techniques to persuade them to come back into the church, or use lawyers to intimidate and harass people that they felt they wanted to influence. So he's a fascinating dude, and he has insight into how Scientology was run, as well as sort of being an example of someone who was, you know, in some way damaged by both Scientology but also the experience of leaving Scientology. He was harassed and attacked after he left Scientology. So he was
harassed and attacked even during the course of you making the film.
And I think he was annoyed about that as well. He felt that I used him to kind of reawake, you know, they'd sort of stopped harassing him, and then when we started the film, it all started up again, which obviously for the film was good, but for him personally and his wife and his kid, it wasn't good. And I think he resents all of that. But there's a bigger context to do with the journey he's on. He no longer views himself as an anti-Scientologist. But the question was about how did that affect me? And I remember him saying something about the karma of, you know, look into your hearts and the karma of doing what you do. I mean, it seemed to – what I took from it was like what you're involved in, Louis, is a kind of dishonest practice, and you will kind of, you know, betray people, the sort of seduce and betray thing, you're a lowlife and a kind of both a ludicrous figure, because he called me an ass clown, and also a kind of moral degenerate. And I really liked Marty, and I still feel warmly towards him, and I feel obviously that, you know, that was something I had to think about, and it was upsetting.
How did you think about it?
Well, I tried to think about to what extent I had sort of done him wrong. And I think he put a lot into the film, and there's a clearly he now feels it was a waste of his time. Having said that, when he first saw the film, he said he liked it. I think I partly process it by seeing it as part of a bigger thing that he's going through, you know, that he's – I think he's suing for peace with Scientology, among other things. So I think he no longer sees Scientology as an enemy, and he no longer wants them as an enemy. So I think that's going on. I'm also aware that, for me, this is a more difficult film than my normal work because I haven't been invited in. And so there's this feeling of having to manage the ethics of it so that it isn't a kind of gratuitous hit job on Scientology, but I'm also being – I want to be fair to Marty and the other ex-Scientologists. I'd love to sit down with Marty. I mean, to some extent, I haven't really fully thought through his criticisms.
I mean, there is inherent in the work you do an element of betrayal to the people who are your subjects. While they have agreed, they've always agreed to be there. They always have an interest in being there, which is to generally to, you know, there are often people who don't have the opportunity to say what they want and have people hear it, and certainly hear it in a relatively unjudgmental way. But at the end of the day, you're not making a film on behalf of white supremacists. And so I feel like I probably I'm going to say 80% sincerely believe that your ingratiation with the subjects of your films is sincere, that you have an interest in people and just want to know what their deal is, and that when you say that you like them, that you, to some extent, you know, in maybe you don't like their ideology or certain of their practices, depending on what the movie is, but that you actually do like them because you're a guy that's, like, interested in people and, like, wants to like them. But that part of the story of their of the film is always going to be you pushing buttons that they don't enjoy having pushed.
I don't know if that's totally true, in the sense that – because what you said was part of what you do is always going to involve betrayal. I think in sporadic cases, there are examples in which people have gone into making a program with me, appearing in a program, and maybe not been happy with how they were portrayed, or felt that actually – in some way, it didn't end up being what they felt they were signing on for. But I don't think that's the majority of the cases. And I've always been careful to, you know, I work under my own name. There's a track record out there for anyone who chooses to look into what I do. I'm not a kind of prankster. I'm not Ali G. And I think part of what makes the shows work is a sense that there's fair dealing going on, you know. And I think... one of the, you know, to take, you know, you mentioned the neo-Nazis. I don't know if it's to my credit or discredit. Like, I didn't get, you know, there was a woman in that called April Gady who was raising her two daughters, Lamb and Lynx, to be a kind of neo-Nazi pop group called Prussian Blue. This was like 12 years ago I made that one. But they were okay with how the show turned out. They weren't under any misapprehension that, you know, we were making a pro-Nazi film, they, you know, or documentary. They knew what it was. Having said that, it's true to say that Tom Metzger, the sort of neo-Nazi leader who has a skinhead following, he wasn't happy with what we did. And I remember turning up later to another Nazi rally that I was writing about for a book, and he said to me, I think he said, you know, I should knock you on your ass for what you did to me in that documentary. But these are the wages of what we do. And actually, you have to accept not so much betrayal. You have to accept a power relationship. You know, putting something on TV where it's watched by, you know, upwards of 3, 4, sometimes 6, 7 million people, and having final edit. And, you know, that's a huge amount of power. And so if some people feel a little bruised by it, it's really understandable.
I think that, like, one of the reasons that I feel like I would rather, like, I feel more comfortable sitting in the space where I'm like, no, Nazis are bad, if I was ever had to interview a Nazi. Like, I'm lucky. I get to interview people like you whose work I like and admire, you know. But, like, if I were in a position where I was interviewing somebody who I was really vehemently opposed to their ideology or whatever, I would feel more comfortable confronting them, mostly because I wouldn't be able to sit in the level of moral responsibility that's involved in deciding whether to do something that someone is, like, if you're interviewing a Nazi and everything goes to Nazis. It's the most universally agreed to be lousy ideology there is. But, like, if you're interviewing...
What about the Islamic State? That we're, like,
okay, let's
that
say
one.
You're interviewing an Islamic State guy. Or lady.
Sure.
Let's say you're interviewing a lady from the Islamic State. You're, like, to some extent, the way that you sit in it is you have to choose some mixture of doing something that this person sitting across from you isn't going to like, because you have offered them a generous ear, but you are going to represent them as what they are, which in the case of the Islamic State is something that is abhorrent. And the other choice, which is to represent them positively because you like them, because you like people, and that's part of why you do what you do. But then in so doing, you have to deal with the moral consequences of, oh, am I making a pro-Islamic State thing? You know what I mean? Like, by pointing out the humanity of terrorists.
I think I hear what you're saying.
So it's, like, easier to just be like, no, I'm against it. I'm confronting this person.
Well, I think if I can put a different spin on it, because I think actually disagreement is not hostile. And I think you go to the Islamic State to interview Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi or his wife or wives, they don't expect you're going to agree with them as an emissary of an infidel country. And disagreement is not necessarily hostile. But I think there's a deeper thing, which is that viewers expect some sort of friction, and understandably so. So there needs to, there can't be coziness or too much coziness. And I remember when we did our neo-Nazi story, we thought we were maybe close to done with filming, and our exec producer came in and said, "You can't finish there. You know, you haven't actually confronted any of these guys in a kind of in a robust and almost sort of assertive, borderline aggressive way. Like, the viewer sees you as a kind of a champion who's going to go in and take them on." And I had to fly back for a third visit. And more or less, there were three main contributors, and kind of in a sequence, see one after another and kind of pick a fight with them. And you can see that actually people need, there is a need, but, you know, rightly or wrongly, to feel that wrongheadedness or viciousness is being confronted, not just like with rational argument, but almost in an emotional and a visceral way that is satisfying. And that's the part of the job that I do find, that's one of the parts of the job that hasn't always come as naturally to me. I mean, the other part, but when this speaks to sort of what you're saying, is if you're exposed to an ideology you really do find deeply abhorrent, it is really dispiriting, you know, the long days you spent kind of like, usually, you know, you might be there for a couple of days and, you know, your camera goes off and like, should we go get a sandwich? And you sit down, it's like you make chit chat and it's this odd feeling of almost like a truce is declared and we're just going to behave like normal people and but secretly knowing that we disagree in this
like
really deep way.
Like it's Christmas Day in World War One.
Kind of. Maybe less fun than that.
No,
but
I've got to say,
Jesse, to be fair, like the Scientology film is a little bit of a throwback in some ways to my Weird Weekends. And for the last 10 years, I've taken on stories in which the contributors are it's less about ideological extremism. I've done stories about crime, about disability, about medical sort of medical stuff, brain injury. And so whether consciously or not, I've sought out stories in which my position as a journalist is a little less kind of emotionally difficult to deal with.
Is that just because you're I feel like if were I in your position, my feelings would get tired.
I don't really know. I don't know. But, you know, I would say that I'm fascinated by religious groups. And if there was a really good – this is going to sound a bit glib, but if a really good cult came along – like I was reading about Reza Aslan. Do you know Reza Aslan's got a new series on CNN, and it's about religious groups on the fringes. And I was reading about it and said, oh, and episode 3 is about a doomsday cult in Hawaii. And I was like, damn, why don't I know about those guys? I wonder if it's those guys I read about. I wish we'd been doing that. You know, I felt.
I imagine you like watching the Source Family, the documentary about the Source Family, and just watching you thinking like, man, California in the 70s.
Yeah, rich pickings. That's good stuff.
Is there a question that you ask when you have forgotten what you were going to ask?
You know, I'm pretty good about keeping my questions in my head. I think the one thing I do is I go back to first principles. I always feel like there's a question before the one that you asked that is the one that you forgot to ask. And usually, this is going to sound really banal, but it's sort of like, why do you do this? Or even, what is the thing that you do? Because before, why do you do this? Like, what is the thing that you do? And it's quite common to get deep into a conversation and sort of forget there's a sort of in the Scientology movie, there's a moment that I'm kind of a little bit proud of almost, where I'm talking to a guy, an ex-Scientologist called Mark.
Wait a minute. You're almost proud of this movie that you're dedicating?
No, in the sense of, like, I try not to be sort of big, because I feel like it's a bigger project than my participation in it. And I sort of feel like I kind of roll with whatever happens in most of the encounters. And so it feels sort of very organic. But there's one moment where it feels like I'm quite professional. And in the interview with Mark Headley, while we're interviewing actors to play, we're auditioning actors to play Tom Cruise. And he starts saying, he's, you know, in Scientology, they say you have to have a dedicated glare. And he talks about the intensity of Tom Cruise's commitment with Scientology and how he goes around confronting and shattering suppression. And I say, but I feel there's a bigger question outside of all of this. Like, why is this so important? And it's this feeling of like, hang on, let's just reboot this conversation and think about what is it that's in Tom Cruise's head that makes him feel that this is so, such a life-changing or world-changing thing. And it's sort of, it's like a really obvious question, but it's the question, like, remind me why anyone should care about this. Maybe that's the question.
Do you feel like that's a question that you end up asking every time in some form or another? Why does this matter? Like, why does this matter to you?
I think probably it's there along the way. There's usually some – I don't know. Sometimes you can't make it too literal. I'm trying to think about – so for example, recently I've been doing shows about addiction, about alcohol addiction. I did a show recently about pimps and prostitution in Houston. And, you know, with addiction, the question is simply, it seems like your life would be so much simpler if you took this, like, your way forward is very clear. There's a fork in the road. And if you stop drinking, you can have a sober life in which you will be healthy, happy, and form stable relationships. And then there's another path which you keep drinking and everything falls to pieces. That seems so obvious. So why can't you do it, right? That's really the only question, in a sense. But actually, you don't always formulate that question. And in prostitution with pimps, it's like, it seems to me that you're involved in a relationship that is, you know, parasitic and predatory, in which the pimp is doing nothing for you. And why is it not clear to you that what would be sensible for you would be to leave this lifestyle and take a straight job? I mean, I'm sort of saying what's so obvious, but sometimes it's the obvious questions that people trip up on. You know, because people try and be intelligent or analytical in a way, and actually, it's more about asking a really simple question and then giving people the space to answer it.
When you say people do that, do you mean me?
Yes.
Yeah, I figured. What can I say?
You're doing a great job, Jesse. I always feel like I'm not a very good interviewee, but that's maybe why I do the job that I do.
You also barely feel proud of anything that you just dedicated to.
I know.
To
I wish I hadn't said that. Now I feel like I've let my movie down.
I mean, there's a moment in the movie that's remarkable to me, which is you're talking to Marty, this guy who was the sort of ideological enforcer of
and physical enforcer.
Yes. exactly, of this organization. You've shown in the film a moment of you interviewing another ex-Scientologist who describes having been punched in the face by Marty during a sort of interrogation.
Yep.
And there's a moment where he does this thing that you've been talking about, which is confronts you over the fact that you ask the same question over and over.
That's right.
Which is something that you do for television in some ways. And he says, just ask me something. Mm. And you say, what did it feel like to punch him in the face?
Yeah.
You guys are sitting next to each other in this, like, Chevy Tahoe.
He laughs, though, doesn't he? Do you remember? And actually, yeah, that was a pretty good question. He laughs, and it turns out that was helpful because he confirms that he did punch him in the face. And I've given him a right of reply, and he makes out like, oh, like his fist was the victim of Mark Headley's face. You know what I mean? Like it really hurt his hand.
He says that jokingly.
I don't think so. I think it hurt his hand.
No, I mean, I think it did hurt his hand, but yeah. I don't think that he is sincerely saying that he was the victim of punching this guy in the face.
No.
I think he's making a joke where punching people hurts from what I've never punched anyone.
No.
He admitted. But I hear that it really hurts.
I think if you hit them hard enough.
Have you ever hit anyone?
My brother, I think I did. I've got a brother who's 2 years older.
Yeah, that's pretty much the perfect person to have hit.
Yeah, I don't think I ever landed a good punch, though.
It seems like if you actually punch somebody, it would really hurt.
Yeah, but it's striking how he may or may not be joking, but Marty does not seem to feel any great degree of regret about having punched Mark Headley.
Have you ever been punched?
In my work, no. In my private life, yes. You want to know when?
I want to know.
But just as a kid, you know, scrapping.
Right. One time I was walking down the street in the Mission in San Francisco where I grew up, and I had on this 49ers jacket. My dad had taken me to Burlington Coat Factory, said I could pick out any jacket I wanted. Picked out this cool denim 49ers jacket, football team for San Francisco. So walking down the street in front of St. Luke's Hospital, saw a kid I was maybe 10. This kid was maybe 15. And he was wearing the same 49ers jacket I was. And as we passed, I said, hey, cool jacket. And he punched me in the face, laughed, and kept walking.
Really?
That's the only time I ever got punched.
I remember as a teenager in my weed smoking days, there was a place where I used to go and score, right, buy my weed. And you would just walk around the dodgy area and kind of look for the nod, like the sort of look of recognition from the dealer. And I remember one guy, he took me, he was like, okay, fine. So you go behind whatever, some little building, and there's an alleyway, and then he's like, okay, give me the money. And I'm like, oh no, I know how this goes down. You give me the weed and then I give you the money. And then he punched me. and then I was like, oh, okay, so that's what we're doing. Oh, fair enough.
I mean, the good news is it means now you're completely physically fearless.
Yeah.
You got over getting punched.
He didn't punch me that – and I don't think it hurt his hand. He didn't punch me that hard. It was just like, you know what, that you think you're buying weed from me. No, that's not what's happening. I'm mugging you.
Well, Louis Theroux, thank you so much for taking all this time to be on this weird podcast about interviews.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you for being pleasure being here.
And thank you for making your wonderful work. I've enjoyed it I hate to do this to you, Louis Theroux, but since I was a kid.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How about that?
Watching Weird Weekends on Bravo.
That? Nice to hear
thinking
that.
It was fantastic.
Let's get the word out.
Yeah.
My Scientology movie.
Yeah. There you go.
Download
it's great.
It.
It's very much worth the download.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much, Louis.
Pleasure.
Louis Theroux, everybody. His latest feature film is called My Scientology Movie. It follows his attempts to delve into the inner workings of the Church of Scientology. You can find it on iTunes, Amazon, wherever else you watch movies. And I recommend it, and all of Louis' work, really highly. You've been listening to The Turnaround. If you like the show, please tell somebody about it. That's all we've got. Please tell somebody, like write somebody an email, post about it on social media, share an interview. It's easy. Just say, oh, it's this weird show about interviewer interviewing interviewers about interviewing. They'll be like, oh, okay, I'll try that. Please do that. Okay. Subscribe, leave us a review in Apple Podcasts, wherever else you get your shows. You can always find our shows at MaximumFun.org. You can also find text versions of our interviews at the Columbia Journalism's website, CJR.org. CJR is a partner of Maximum Fun in presenting this show. Their mission is to encourage excellence in journalism in the service of a free society. You can also check out their podcast, which is called The Kicker. All our music is provided to us by Mobius Van Chockstraw. You can check out his music at chopsmusic.com. The creator of The Turnaround is me, Jesse Thorne. Our producers are Kara Hart and Nick Liao. Our senior producer at Maximum Fun is Laura Swisher. Our managing director is Bikram Chatterjee. Special thanks to Kyle Pope, Emily Erskine, and Daryl Frost for making the show a reality. I'll catch you next time on The Turnaround.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.